Hey SEOs and content marketers, say goodbye to crazy spreadsheet mashups and experience unprecedented connectivity between your SEO planning and reporting data. Introducing Audience Key, technology for keyword mapping, content brief automation, and rank tracking that form an SEO strategy system providing unparalleled feedback loops between planning, reporting, and optimization activities. Put your time and energy into strategy, not data upkeep. Visit audiencekey.com and apply for a free trial today.
After Labor Day. This is Jim Hedger from Digital Always Media and Christine Schackinger from Sites Without Walls.
Hi, everybody.
And it's been, they say that, the real year begins after Labor Day, after summer ends. Kids are back, full swing back in school, and summer's waning to an end, and people get really serious about stuff after Labor Day, and that's when we start gearing up towards the Christmas holiday season, and that's when stuff gets real. And it was a very, very real week in the last week, albeit a truncated and shortened one due to Labor Day. Thanks to Audience Key and Wix Studio, our sponsors. But you know what? The core update's done. Core update ended a couple of days ago.
It is. I made a post on LinkedIn about it being done soon, and it was 10 minutes later I had to edit the post.
Was it a good core update for you?
For me, generally, yes. And any client I had that I took on as an audit recovery client, they have all recovered their downs from the core update. There is somebody I was helping pro bono because all those very small, people got hit by the September one and then also the March one. And that one recovered the March one, but not the September, just a little bit of September.
Well, before we go further, you said recovered from the core update. And I think there's a lot of people who might have expect you to say recovered from the helpful content update, because people were really hoping that this update would be salvation, a solution to the HCU blues.
Yeah, so for those that don't know, I hate how Google does this now, I really do. In March, April, they launched the spam manual actions, the spam update. They're supposed to do something about the site-wide HCU, but we know that they didn't because no one recovered. And then they did the core update, and then they did the core update with the helpful content being applied at the page level. And they called all of that the core update, which, is not confusing at all for anybody. And then back in September, when they had the HCU that was separate from the core update, the site-wide one, they had a core update right before that, and they had one right after that that overlapped. So I had a lot of people come to me and say they were hit by the HCU, but when I really looked at it, they were not. They were hit by the core updates. So those, I believe it was August and then October, those have recovered. The HCU in the middle of September has not. And I don't know that anybody was hit by the HCU in March, April. I've seen the March, April traffic recover. But I do think that the HCUs, also from what we've read from Barry Schwartz, who did a poll, there's still most people are not recovering from that one.
Okay. I had a mixed reaction core update. A couple of the sites I'm working with did extremely well for it. And most of them, nothing, no change. Nothing bad. I mean, they didn't lose traffic or anything, but nothing seemed to have happened for them.
That's okay. I mean, the ones I'm working with are specifically clients who were hit in between August, October last year or March, April this year. So those are all hockey stick recoveries. They're getting back all the traffic from the March, April update or the core update of last year. Just not that September one. My feeling is, I know it's just my opinion, I don't have anything substantial to base it on. I still believe their HCU is broken. They don't know how to fix it. Because if you took off the site-wide and then it was a month later they applied the page level, we should have seen the site-wide sites do some recovery and then do the page level and then maybe go back down or maybe not to lift off the pages. Because remember, they knew what pages of the HCU supposedly were bad because that's how they determined how much you lost in traffic. So like 10% of your pages were bad, not so much. 80% of your pages were bad according to them, then you'd lose most of your traffic, right? Site-wide. So they supposedly know what pages. So normally what they would do is lift the site-wide and then, or lift the site-wide and leave it the ones on the pages that they know they thought were bad. And then people would experience recovery because their pages that weren't bad would return. But that didn't happen. So I still think it's an issue of it being broken and they can't fix it. But that's just me.
I don't have any sites in my stable that were affected by the HCU. But if I did, one of the things I'd be looking at this point, I'd be operating under the assumption that an emptying lake lowers all boats. So if I got hit by the HCU, chances are many of my competitors also got hit by the HCU. That'd be the very first thing I'd look at. If that's the case, then there's obviously everybody has to re-earn their way back into the rankings, and everybody is competing for the same place that, well, you know, I might have been, or my sites might have been at one time, but now everyone is competing for that again. That's the angle I would be taking, not that it's necessarily mine by right, but that everything is being reevaluated, often against itself. And yeah, often when you get into the top 10, you sometimes get lodged in there because that's the ranking that's supposed to be there. There's a lot of traffic to it. It acquires a good set of backlinks to it, and you know, it becomes almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy that's supposed to be there. When that all gets taken away, everything's got to get reevaluated for everyone.
Oh yeah, but no, I just don't. I agree. Normally that would be true, but I don't see that here because there's no recovery. So there's very few.
Well,
and
indeed.
I think probably
the whole point I'm getting at.
Yeah, but no, but it wouldn't work that way where the other people are down and you're down and you all have to recover together. That's not how they work. But the thing is the ones that did have recoveries, we have seen people post like hockey stick recoveries on HCUs. I would like to look at those and actually see if they're really HCUs because these people didn't work on those sites. They just are tracking those sites. These are sites I've actually worked with. Or sites that I was helping out with, so I actually like have access to their data, and like I said, the CUs where we did the work, they all came back, no problem at all. But the HCU from last year, the one site I know that's really struggling, they got all their March April traffic back, but as of the end yesterday, no, 2 days ago, they got maybe 1/10 of their September traffic back. And I'm hearing from Barry Schwartz at that poll, and 44% had drops, 27% had increases, 29% had no change. And we can assume a lot of that 27% are core update victims. I shouldn't say victims, sorry, core update devaluations, not HCUs. But I really do think the machine learning is just broken. Because there's been no, if you move to the page, the site-wide, to the page level, there should have been recoveries of some sort because they would have removed the devaluation on a lot of pages on the site. So those would be able to regain unless they're removing the link values and you have to re-earn the links. That would be really weird. I just think it's machine learning and the core algorithms. And as Matt Cutts always said, he would never do it because if it broke, they couldn't fix it. And I really think at this point it's broken. They can't fix it. As we're looking at, and look at how much negative press I got from the last two. And they said this time we'd see a lot of recoveries, but we're not seeing a lot of recoveries. So I just think it's broken. But again, that could just be me. I could be totally wrong. But I've been doing this for a long time and I've never seen a update act like this where people just don't recover at all when it reruns.
If there are recoveries out there, speak up. I haven't heard about a lot of them either. Maybe they'll come in coming weeks. But I haven't heard a lot either. If there are some out there, speak up. It'd be good to learn from your experiences. And if you're still struggling to get back into traffic and into the strong rankings, also speak out. You know, let people know what you've been doing. It is worth collaborating because that's where. Ideas get refined into, you know, actual actionable items. So
Yeah, and like more normal, like most core updates, the ones I recovered are like 80-90% technical. So some page layout, some content, but mostly technical.
Ironically,
So yeah.
if people do start really heavily collaborating on their experience and improving their sites and trying to get their rankings back in forms and stuff, Google's going to have a whole new search result layout that will feature not only the form answer but comments to that form answer. So it might make, weaving your way through trying to figure out how other people got into the exact place you're looking a little bit easier.
Maybe. Yeah, we'll see. I think I think some people are starting to look at possible legal action. I don't know that anything will come of it, but there's a little bit of chatter on interwebs that some of the smaller publishers are trying to come together and sue Google over it over this issue because I just don't think at this point it's the sites. I think it's Google.
Well, and it would be most interesting to see how far that
Yeah.
went in a court.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if it did actually go anywhere, it would be also very interesting to see how quickly Google paid everybody just to make it go all Google way.
Exactly, that's so true. So
Okay,
true.
so after you invested untold billions of dollars into something, like just staggering, like nations' entire gross domestic product output worth of wealth into something, what exactly do you think is going to happen if someone breaks a rule? This is what worries me when we have international treaties on stuff, because they're really hard to enforce, but they're good to have
Yeah.
because they set guidelines. And the world's first international treaty started in the Council of Europe. It's called the Framework Convention on Artificial Intelligence, signed by the UK, the US, and the EU, and several other sort of like secondary nation states, countries that aren't part of the massive legal consortium, the large economies of the EU, UK, and US. But Canada, Australia, Israel, Japan, New Zealand, a number of the other smaller countries that are also heavily participating in the e-commerce and the internet and AI world. There is now a framework convention on artificial intelligence. It defers implementation and enforcement to the state level, but basically it boils down to respect law, respect human rights, and strive for truth and accuracy in the creation of AIs.
Yeah, and it's actually a positive for the development of AI. So Facebook's Meta was building a large language model, as we all know, or has a Llama 2, but it had to stop rolling out products to the EU because of regulations that prevented Europeans from having access to it. So by having this framework where we all agree what the rules are, then Meta will be able to create and launch it in the EU because it will know what the law is going to require of them. As we both know, there's no teeth in the law whatsoever. It's pretty much we'll follow it if we want to, but I think for business development and innovation, they probably will follow it so that they can all be operating off the same page. So you don't like spend billions and then EU's like, nope, you're not coming here.
Well, certainly,
So.
yeah. That's exactly what international treaties are about. They provide the framework within different legal jurisdictions can sort of do stuff with each other, work with each other, and still have a mechanism for dispute settlement and stuff.
Exactly.
So yeah, this is a good thing. I live in one of the jurisdictions that has a number of AI restrictions due to Canada's stringent privacy laws, much very similar to the EU. So I'm all for a re-understanding of laws, international law around AI, based on an international framework. It's a good thing from where I'm sitting.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's a really good thing.
Okay, so those are I think probably the two biggest stories are going to have like the sweeping impact on the business and the SEO world and stuff. But some heavy stuff went down this week.
Yes.
So Number one, the Department of Justice has indicted. Is this a full indictment?
I believe they were two were charged, websites were seized. So two Royal Russian Times employees were indicted for covertly funding and directing a U.S. company that published thousands of videos and other social media in furtherance of Russian interests. That's the official report from the Office of Public Affairs at the Department of Justice. So the employees were deployed nearly 10 million to publish RT curated content. Russian Times is RT, which garnered millions of views through a Tennessee-based online content creation company. And some of those influencers are people like Tim Pool, which people are probably very aware of for being a pretty scathing person on social media. So it's very interesting, though. They didn't actually know they were being paid by
They
Russia.
absolutely knew they were being paid by
No,
Russians. They're just
according
saying they didn't know they were being paid,
no,
but
the
I'm
people
sorry, they knew.
the two people that run the company, yes, they did. They
Okay.
have the wire transfers. They called. They had some name for it, like
So
buying
Tim,
goods
so so
for
so so
iPhones.
Tim Pool came up with his editorial feelings
No.
about Ukraine on his own when they actually absolutely mirror RT talking points, and he
No, no,
didn't
no.
know that RT was paying him.
No, he didn't know. They did not know that all the
Okay,
reporting is,
but
but they did not know that they were hired by RT. Doesn't mean they weren't hired to do the influence campaigns. They just didn't know it was directly from Russia. That's all.
okay,
So,
I find that literally, I find that claim to be incredible.
I
In
agree,
every
but
use of the word incredible.
and that could change as the investigation continues, right? But right now, Tenet Media, a network of influencers known for their right-wing views that include David Rubin, Tim Pool, Lauren Southern, and Benny Johnson. That's from Al Jazeera, but you see the same thing in every news report today.
Oh, that's their names. That's just that, that is truth. That is true.
So apparently, I mean, let's put this like, it's like someone said, "Hey, Jim and Christine, we want to hire you to tweet it and do social about SEO." And you're like, cool, that's awesome. And then you find out it's like some nefarious group and they've been funneling you the narratives, but you agreed with the narratives. So you were happy to share them. It's kind of like that. They got paid, that Tenet, the media firm, got paid $10 million. The two people that took the money hid it under something they called like,
Mattress.
mattress. They also hid it under like iPhone purchase, stuff like that. But these influencers have been doing these narratives at the instruction of this company. They just didn't know where the funds came from. But I have to say, though, my question is, let's say there's no Russia involved at all, right? But if you're being paid by a company to push a narrative by FEC's law, I think it was SEC law, not FEC's, SEC, you have to disclose that like on every post. You're being paid to push a narrative, right? You're being paid for this. And I have never seen them declare that. I think they'd be in trouble either way because, federally, that is a huge violation of the law. But it will be interesting to see how this comes down because the two Russians have been already indicted. There's also several other investigations going on. So they seized disinformation websites. I think there are 22 of them that came out of the Kremlin, and those are now been taken down. And there's also another investigation that was released today in relation to other disinformation outlets, but I don't know the details yet. So it sounds like it's a very broad investigation.
Yes.
So, yeah. So know who's paying you.
Well, again, I think it literally staggers the imagination that these people were unaware of where their funds were coming from. I know what they say in their defense.
Well,
They,
then they might have thought.
in fact, Tim Pool says that he and his collaborators were the victims in all this, because they were unaware of where the money's come from, and boy, does he feel like a dupe now.
And it could be they just thought the
Sorry, I
people
just don't
were like,
believe that.
well, I could believe that they thought they were Russian, just that they didn't know the money was coming literally from the Kremlin.
Okay.
Like a Russian oligarch is helping to fund this disinformation campaign or something, which is illegal because of the sanctions, but but that these guys are going to fall under all sorts of laws. So it'll be interesting to see which one they prosecute under, because if they were doing work with Russian Times, I believe RT's been sanctioned.
They have.
So you're working with people who've been sanctioned. That's illegal. And then you're not disclosing you're being paid to run these narratives. That's illegal. And now you add to it, you're being paid directly by Putin's people. So now you got a whole nother level of stuff in there. And you can say you didn't know that part, but you can't say you didn't know the other parts.
And a very large swath of the internet public, especially the American internet public, turns to these voices as their credible news voices. Deepening, just a deepening concern. I do hope that this prosecution goes forward is ultimately successful, because it's a great concern.
It's a great prosecution, though, you know, because in all the disinformation we've been fighting since, we know, officially 2015, when the affiliate marketers are making lots of money on political posts, fake ones. There hasn't been really a administration, DOJ investigation, shutting down, seizing websites, all that kind of stuff. So there might be people that decide to, they don't want to be as involved. Not Russia, of course, but I mean people in the United States.
If it costs you to be involved, like literally costs you, either through fine or even you know, jail times, then yeah, people might not want to be involved. And I do care about the politics on one level, but this isn't necessarily about the politics. The web has become a cesspool of disinformation. Yeah. Of it's not the place that we were building businesses in years ago that promoted people coming to it to buy things, that promoted people to, you know, explore it and use it as a means to communicate. Now it's a pretty toxic environment, and a lot of that toxicity comes from misuse of an incredible communications device. And personally, I dislike that it takes the courts to enforce some level of truthfulness in this medium. But unfortunately, it seems to. And I think we all have an interest in that, because we need people who buy stuff from our clients to believe in the environment they're shopping in.
Well, and also the disinformation, like you said, it's not political only. Political is just part of it. There's so many pieces of disinformation, even crazy stuff. Like, there's this group that made fun of all that by saying birds don't exist, right? Yep. They created a birds don't exist website. I forget exactly what they call it. There are people now that literally believe birds don't exist, but they're fake. I saw people posting on TikTok a couple weeks ago.
This could be very problematic.
I think media literacy is something we really start needing to teach in like kindergarten.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have, in the case of birds being real, basic kindergarten is something we need to teach in kindergarten.
That too.
Okay. So everyone has been talking about something that's coming after ChatGPT 4.0. This is probably it. GPT Next has been teased by OpenAI's lead exec in Japan. GPT Next is supposed to be fundamentally a gajillion times better than ChatGPT 4.0 is. And it's on its way. It's ChatGPT 5-ish, and it's going to be out very soon.
But it's not 5. They do not have 5 yet.
Okay, so it's not 5, it's GPT Next, and it's going to be awfully cool, and so very soon.
Yeah, this way. Kind of funny, right? Now we had GPT-4, GPT-4-0-0-H. I mean, there's a zero, but they meant O. And now we have just Next, because they're like, we're not getting to 5 anytime soon, so we're just going to call Next. So,
well, it sounds like a vastly improved iteration on the 4-point-whatever series. This is engineers naming stuff, and I honestly think if Webcology has added any value to the tech industry of all of them, it's the idiom, do not let engineers name stuff.
Please let your marketing people do it. The thing is, you know, one quick note though, OpenAI has said every time that they release something, it's this major improvement, and then the tests come out and they're like, yeah, not so much. So we'll see. But, you know, for people who are, you know, big enthusiasts of OpenAI, hopefully you will get a much better product.
Okay, and when you get this better product, you're going to look at it and think, Oh my God, I gotta save so much time for this. This is like a labor-saving device.
I
Just
love
like
this
people,
story so much.
just, you know what, there's historical precedence for this, which I'm gonna go to first, okay?
Okay.
Do you know that when the dryer was invented, the washing machine and dryer, people thought, wow, I don't have to cart my clothes all the way across town to the laundromat or go all the way to the river to wash them myself, which takes like all day long. I don't have to do this. I could now put them in the washing machine and go read a book or something. Well, as it turns out, when you put your clothes in the washing machine, you now have time to scrub your floors or repaint the deck or refurnish the bathroom or something. You have time to do more stuff. And the same thing happened with the invention of the dishwasher. The same thing happened with several labor-saving devices that saved us time from doing stuff. We used that time to do more stuff. AI, much generative AI is really good at summarizing information really fast, but it's not necessarily accurate. And if accuracy is important to you, and I don't know about you, Christine, but it is to me, you kind of got to go check on what was created for you. And sometimes the checking on it, the editing, takes longer than just doing it yourself in the first place.
Yeah,
And
there's. Okay.
I'm sorry, there was a test for an AI in Australia, and as it turns out, that's exactly what they found.
Yeah, they actually found out that humans not only are slightly better than the AI in summarizing the large language model. We should just call it generative AI so I don't confuse it. They are way better, much, much better than they are. And then, as you said, because of the hallucinations issue, which is just, it publishes things that are incorrect. This is why I don't use it much. It's like I have to determine what's true and what's not. And I might as well just do what I used to do because it's not that much difference in the time savings and just go find out for myself because otherwise I have to find out for myself anyway. But I love, so this article in Crikey about this study done in Australia, it says human summaries ran up the score by significantly outperforming on identifying references to ASIC documents, so that was what they tested on. In the long document, a type of task that reports notes is a notoriously hard task for this kind of AI, but humans still beat the technology across the board. So apparently the AI summaries missed emphasis, nuance, and context, included incorrect information or missed relevant information, sometimes focused on auxiliary points or introduced irrelevant information. Three of the five reviewers said they guessed that they were reviewing AI content. Yeah, you can tell that now, can't you, when you see something, Jim? Oh, this has to be AI. Like, you can just tell. So these are the things I think you and I would say we see in AI content, right? Emphasis, nuance, context, incorrect information, relevant information. Google's overview AI is often put in three different viewpoints or two different viewpoints that contradict each other. So yeah, it seems that they're not better. They actually can make your work take longer. And I'm just happy this story exists.
If when it comes to scale, AI can speed things up, I'm sure. But again, if it, if you if you're doing something large scale, you're quality assurance checking large scale. It's how to say this. The concept of induced demand is an old one. And like if you make the highway bigger, you're just going to get more attract more cars over time and probably create even larger traffic jams. Similarly, if everything is being created by AI and AI makes mistakes and AI trains on the stuff that was created that made mistakes, it becomes the well, again, the snake eating is its own tail sort of phenomena or induced demand writ large. So again, we'll see what happens. I can't, there's billions upon billions upon billions, like the fortunes of nations being invested into improving and training AIs. They're going to work this out. or they're going to die.
Yeah,
And
the predictions right now are not positive, but we'll see. Also, so people know they use Meta's open source model, Llama 2-70B, and apparently that's considered one of the best models that exists. So, and it was done for the Australian Australian government. I am tripping over my words today.
So I just call them Aussies. They won't mind.
Aussie.
Okay, so yeah. Let's shift gears a little bit. We're actually we're a half hour into the show. We've got a whole bunch more to cover, and this one's kind of fun, and it leads to a whole series of expensive stories. But remember that antitrust case a few months ago that against Google, the affectionately known as Thing One, one about Google using its massive search monopoly to basically reinforce its own sites.
Yes.
That could well have been the linchpin that has released a tsunami, an avalanche of litigation. And Google, I mean, it's hard to estimate this kind of thing, but there are people who suggest Google could be facing billions or perhaps hundreds of billions in litigation in the coming years, because that's just how many people is kind of pissed off.
And rightfully so, because the one we're talking about, so Google faces a possible $100 billion litigation avalanche over its ads. This is not over just the basic monopoly. That's the second antitrust case we talked about last week. So it uses dominance in text ads to charge super competitive prices, or prices above what would be sustainable in a competitive market, which allowed it to earn monopoly profits on text ads, like those appear near the top of the search results. So apparently they're suing for the overages, basically. Like, hey, we want our money back. And because of the DOJ is the one who won the case, all that testimony is available for anyone to use in the next case. And that case had a lot to do with their monopolistic practices on ads. So, and the EU has already found them to be a monopoly when it comes to their ad networks.
So one brick pulled out from the wall causes the rest of the bricks to sag a little bit. And once those bricks start crumbling, the wall starts to go down.
It definitely does. And I am curious how Google let itself get in this position. But now that it is in this position, yeah, it could have definitely. I mean, it'll take years and years for us to go through the courts. But they could be facing several hundred billion dollars not just fines, like repayments.
I know exactly how Google got this. I was watching this video the other day with Eric Schmidt. He was speaking at Stanford. I think you're familiar with it, with the video.
Yeah.
And Schmidt talked about one of the reasons AI is moving the whole move fast, move forward, break stuff, don't worry about it philosophy that built Web 2.0 and now seems to be underpinning the AI era. Don't worry about it. We're huge. We'll break laws. We got lawyers, they'll work it out. But go get what you can now. Grab territory, stake it, turf it, this is ours, be known for it, get it now. And let lawyers deal with it later. That's the philosophy that Schmidt articulated in this conference. And I believe it's the philosophy he brought to and anybody who was working in search at that time when the crawlers were going out and just hoovering the web and other people's creations. And remember when Google was trying to go after copyrighted books, just everything. Move fast, grab what you can, make it part of your turf, and let the lawyers deal with it later. That's how they got here. That's how they got in this position. And now the lawyers are dealing with it.
Yeah, but the lawyers are usually better at fending all this off, and now not so much. So we'll see what happens.
Well, I mean, there was so much money to be made. I mean, just so much money. If they could be sued for $100 billion, imagine how much money there was to be made. So speaking of, what do you do when, like, you know, you've made a whole bunch of money, so much that you really don't know what to do with it, so you give it over to somebody else who's also made a whole bunch of money, and they take it and they light it on fire?
Pretty much.
What do you do? Like, do you get mad at them? Do you snub them at the bar? Do you not buy them a drink or a mint julep at the Derby? Like, what do you do?
If you're smart, while the ship is going down, if there's a lifeboat, you get out and paddle fast away. And that's what some of the investors in X are looking at doing.
So how much are we looking at? Like we got investors who put in insane amounts of money to facilitate the purchase of Twitter, Twixter, X in 2022. Like, how much are they trying to pull out now?
It depends on which investor it is. Because the investor, this story is in the New Republic, and the person they're talking about is an investor who's pretty in very minority stock. He only has a million in there, a Ross Gerber. But Jack Dorsey lost $720 million on the losses. Twitter has lost, or I will not call it X. Twitter has lost 90% of its value since he bought it. 90%. For all the CEOs out there that I see posting on LinkedIn, what a great job he's doing with no staff. 90%, that's all I'm going to say. The only one that doesn't seem to be bothered is the prince, the Saudi prince, Al-Walid bin Talal, I believe that's how you say it. He invested $2 billion, but says he's very happy with his investment and felt that there's no devaluation whatsoever. Now, the U.S. banks, the merger and acquisition departments of the ones that did this, I believe, $12 billion or $13 billion investment, they had to reduce the salaries of their M&A staff 50% based on just this investment. So apparently it just depends on how much money you have. If you have more money than the universe, then you might think $2 billion is not a big deal. and if you don't, you know, if you're Jack Dorsey, you might think $720 million is a very big deal. So, but they've lost, all of them have lost a lot of money.
This is from the Leopards Ate My Face file, no doubt.
Yeah. And Ross Gerber did give Musk a deadline that if he doesn't have it done by a certain date, he is exiting for sure. He's a small stake player, but once one exits, probably others will follow. And just for the record, Twitter did lay off 75% of its employees. So this is where you're at.
A few years ago, did you hear the story about Arbitrage Pizza?
Arbitrage and Pizza, I think.
Arbitrage Pizza. But this was a company. I think it was one of the food pickup deliveries services. It could have been DoorDash, could have been Uber Eats, could have been, you know, one of the Skip the Dishes, one of those companies.
Oh yes, I do remember the story. It was Uber Eats.
So they were they were undercutting a pizza restaurant by featuring its pizza for actually more than the pizza company was charging for its pizza. So the pizza company simply ordered 1,000 pizzas from itself, didn't make them, but pocketed the difference. That was very clever, and they got away with it until they wrote the article that I think ended up in Rolling Stone and then went viral. This is kind of the same sort of thing. If you want to make a million to invest in X, here's how you do it, but you might get in trouble. This guy ended up with 10 million. Yeah. This North Carolina musician used AI, 52-year-old dude named Michael Smith, used AI to create music, songs.
Songs. Hundreds of thousands of fake songs by fake bands, and then put them on streaming services where they were enjoyed by an audience of, I'm going to let you guess, humans or fake listeners?
Well, probably mostly fake listeners.
Fake listeners, yeah.
But every click is a couple of cents here and there. And if you get enough clicks, you can, over time, come up with a great deal of money. And this guy came up with $10 million before getting caught.
Yeah, $10 million over 7 years. His name is Michael Smith. He was accused in a federal indictment on Wednesday of stealing royalty payments, which I didn't know was I thought it was theft, but I didn't know there was an actual crime of stealing royalty payments.
Yeah.
I think it's just like, and artists had names like Callous Post, Calorie Screams, Calvinistic Dust. I kind of like some of these names. Gothic Washstands. Those were also written by AI, obviously. Zymo Technical. And Zygophilum.
Yeah.
Zygophilum. And they were top performers on Amazon Music, Apple Music, and Spotify. So, yeah, I mean, you know, until he added the fake listeners. If he didn't add the fake listeners, I don't know that he would have been charged. I mean, you can put a fake band up and fake songs up, but wire fraud and money laundering conspiracy is what he was charged with. So I'm assuming it's because he had fake listeners.
Yep. For what it's worth, other bands have put up 3 minutes and 20 seconds of silence and charged for that file as well. That was actually legal. That would be legal.
Yeah, that went totally viral.
Ask John Cale. He'll tell you.
Yeah.
Okay, so Sam Altman has said that he thinks it would be completely impossible to create ChatGPT without using copyrighted material, which is, you know, probably true. It had to study on something in the earliest days. But now that we're moving forward, a new study is suggesting that 57% of content that's available on the internet is either AI generated or has been translated using an AI algorithm.
Yeah, apparently mostly this is about translated, not just regular content. That'd be a little insane.
Nevertheless, this suggests that more than half the content that's out there, new content on the internet, is AI affected. And that is going to subtly affect AI and search results and the web itself. But that copyrighted material is becoming diluted at a rapid rate.
Yeah.
But so, he's probably right. You can't create intelligence without facsimile of intelligence without the world's literature.
Well, the thing is that, one, it's coming from Sam Altman, who wants to be able to do this without charge costs or very little. The head of Microsoft said, it's all available to us. There's no such thing as a copyright. The problem is they're running out of content as it is to train on. And we know from what we've covered in the past, synthetic data, meaning their own output, makes it far worse. So, per the study, Dr. Ila Shumilov, I'm sorry, I'm probably butchering that name, from the University of Oxford said, it is surprising how fast model collapse kicks in and how elusive it can be. At first, it affects minority data, the data that is badly represented. It then affects diversity of the outputs and the variance reduces. Sometimes you observe small improvement for the majority data that hides away the degradation of the performance on minority data, but model collapse can have serious consequences. So basically, if it trains on itself, it's going to get worse because there's really not enough variety in the outputs.
The laws of exponential numbers say that has to happen. The only thing I dispute with what that professor said is the word surprising. Like, why is it surprising?
I think it's just how fast.
Indeed. I'm surprised it's taking this long. The laws of exponential growth just say it has to happen this way.
And if you list, if you read the stuff on LinkedIn, the Goldman Sachs report, the latest report from, I believe it was McKinsey, it's all these people, and then you read the leaders in this field, and we're just going to talk about generative AI, how expensive it is, how they can't fix things like hallucinations. And then we get into model collapse because of the content it's creating, and they're running out of content to train. When Goldman Sachs says it has OpenAI and generative AI has like a 12-month life expectancy, I don't think they're that wrong, unless some major breakthrough comes through.
Well, for those in the know, when you hear about McKinsey writing that there maybe have been mistakes in running after AI investment so quickly, for those in the know, if that makes you giggle a little bit, you're excused.
for sure.
No, you got it. You got that.
Yeah.
Okay. Where are we going next? Something that that just sort of folds into all this.
One real quick thing we should just cover real fast. Mm-hmm. We don't have to do a lot of discussion on it, so people know, because a lot of people in our industry we know use OpenAI's custom GPTs and their GPT store. Just so people know, they do no security checks on anything that's in that GPT store. And now they're also finding out that 100 plus of the custom GPTs violate their policies. So content issues, explicit content, cheating, AIDS, unvetted medical advice. So be very, very careful when you go into the ChatGPT, OpenAI's GPT marketplace, when you use those what do we call them? Plugins? They're not plugins, but I guess they call them plugins. When you use those, that you could be using something that could put malware on your site or give you bad information or just doesn't follow any of their rules because they don't vet it. It's not like getting a WordPress plugin from one of the WordPress companies, which has vetted it for security issues and all that. You're basically out in the wild west and you're slapping it on your car, like driving by things and just put it on. Hopefully they don't drain your gas or make it crash, but be very careful with those.
Here's an intro. Here's a how AI affects SEO directly story. This is actually kind of cool. There's a new Chrome AI feature that is going to search the Chrome AI history, or the web browsing history, to come up with a page or a URL that you've seen before, based again on your browsing history and input that you give, either visual input, an image, or keyword input. In this case, the example used in the Google example is Burberry sweater, England. I think this is kind of cool because people will actually start using it if they use Google like a filing cabinet, and a bunch of search users, as you know, Christine, with use Google as filing cabinets, right? They remember where stuff is because they know it'll be the third result at Google.
Yeah.
So for people who do that, this will be a good feature, a feature that they're going to use kind of heavily, which will mean you need to, as an SEO, exploit this new form of what's probably going to be direct traffic.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I turned it off as soon as I got it because it's just a big panel on the right side of my screen I didn't need. But so it works in two ways. If you use like small like small terms, you're not using a lot of words or stuff, they just do search like normal, or they just do it through the title tag and URL. But that means you want to make sure your title tags and URLs are optimized properly. If they do a deep dive into it, they'll also be looking at things, not just the content on the page, but metadata in your images, how your images are named. So you want to make sure that you're optimizing those as well. So really basic SEO 101. But a lot of companies overlook all that kind of optimization. And right, that's just taken the priority of that optimization up quite a bit. So titles, URLs,
Alt
images.
tags for images, and
Yeah.
again,
And
do not
metadata.
spam the alt tag. Use the alt tag to, give a gentle description of the image, and you'll probably do well by this feature.
Yeah, and be careful because there is a hidden devaluation factor for spamming alt text. I
Yeah, I
know
don't
because,
know.
yeah.
Yeah, indeed, be good with the alt text, please.
Yeah, we had a client who got hit by that, and they're like, "Oh, you spammed 8,000 pieces of alt text. Let's take that out and see how it goes." Oh, you got your site back. So,
Remembering alt text is actually supposed to be there to be used by persons with visual impairment. That's what powers the
yes.
screen readers and describes images for persons with visual impairment. Use the alt text that way. Remember who it's for. Describe the image. That's what it's there for.
You'll be sent to a special place in hell if you spam alt text. If you don't believe me, turn on your screen reader and do a
You really should be
website.
indeed.
Yes.
Okay. Now, if you are spamming a bunch of stuff and somehow you generate a spam score, it's okay to ignore that spam score, although it's not okay to spam a bunch of stuff. But anyone scoring you on a spam score in any way is probably spamming you. That's really smurfy, eh?
Yeah, well, basically, it's just a third-party score, which may or may not represent anything Google's looking at.
Well, yeah.
So don't worry
Google
too
doesn't
much
have a
about them.
spam score, so anybody who does give
Yeah.
you a spam score is not Google.
Right. If you get a spam manual action or a spam, you're hit by the spam algorithm, it's because there's a whole bunch of low-quality indicators on your site. It wasn't like a couple things got together and you got a score from Google. That's not how it works.
Okay, so
So
if you
don't worry about
or
it.
your client or someone you love gets a message saying you got a bad spam score, you can probably ignore it, especially if
You
it's if
know,
and tell your
I
client to ignore it.
tell your client to ignore it, but you check it out and make sure that there's not something spammy about the page. But
Well, you should
yeah,
be doing that
but
every
don't
day
take
anyway,
it
right?
as yeah, you should. So we've got a WordPress. We got some information. WordPress is locking down security for all plugins and themes, which is pretty awesome. So they're going to add two-factor authorization to when you do a commit access, which just means you have the ability with plugins if they're hacked. They could commit to the code base. They won't be able to do that anymore because of two-factor authorization. And then, I'm sorry, that's on everything, but also on the commit level. And then they're using subversion passwords, SVNs, which is an additional layer of security for authenticating developers as people who have access to the code. So right now, if you just give me admin access, I can access everything. So now you'll be able to separate the code layer from just a general admin and only allow your developers or people who should have access to have access. And that also will make it harder for someone to commit changes to your database, because not only do they have to get through your admin password, but they'd have to get through the SVN password. And possibly, if you set it up, two-factor authorization. Now, that's huge. I mean, such a simple thing to probably protect millions of sites from getting hacked every year.
So I have my WordPress site set on instant update. If there's a new version, it just updates itself. Is this going to affect me?
I don't know. They didn't say if it's rolling out. And I'm sure it's going to roll out to all frameworks at some point. I just don't know how quickly. Because it wouldn't make sense to just have it roll out on anything going through.
Oh, indeed. No, it has to roll out of pretty much everything. Everything,
yeah.
Given how WordPress at one time was powering easily 50% or just
it
over
is now.
50%.
Yeah.
Is it still
Yeah, I
with
just
all
saw
the
it.
other options out there, including
Yeah.
Shopify and
Yeah.
Wix and et cetera?
Like 48.9% is what I
Okay,
saw
so
as
it's
a
still a
statistically.
juicy target for
Yeah.
hackers.
Oh, yeah. Especially when it's easy to hack something. So it won't prevent all WordPress from being hacked, but it'll definitely cut down a lot on the problems with WordPress.
You know what? Any security that's useful security is probably good security on the web.
I think we need to make a song about that.
Well, somebody does. I don't.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, Becky, just a second, because I did forget to say this. I
Oh,
got
yeah.
on good advice. When you put a URL into like a ChatGPT or an LLM, they actually don't read the document. They judge it from the URL itself. So if you're not optimizing your URLs and you're hoping to get like good information back in the LLM someone's using, you won't, because basically that's what they're using to write the page. I got this from someone who specializes in AI research. So,
Okay.
yeah. So we got, we're coming towards, I know towards the end, but we got our fast stories. I think we can get through all of them. And none
Probably.
of these require a lot of
Okay.
discussion.
This one should be easy. If you have a fragment URL,
I mean, hashtag after your.
xyz.com/ fragment URL hashtag example 3. Do not make that the canonical. That's its own URL. Like, it's going to move you to another point on the page, but don't make that the canonical link, because Google thinks it's stupid.
Yeah, Google doesn't like canonicals that have hashes in them. Now, weirdly, people will see things in the hash on the SERP page in the site links below the listing, and they'll think, oh, Google reads that part. It doesn't at all. It just is using that, the language you put in the hash to show there. So it's not looking at that. So it's been a canonical. It can really mess up your canonicals.
Okay. Google's got a new shopping search design. It's slicker, more colorful, and pretty nice looking, but it might take a few moments to get used to.
Yeah, it's starting to look like the design of a website's shopping feature. Like, it doesn't look like search anymore at all. It's like, basically, it's like, oh, I went to, oh, no, I'm not on the site's search page or their, you know, commerce page. I'm on Google. So sometimes it's good. Sometimes it's really not. When I'm not looking for a product or to purchase, I'm looking for information.
Feeling the vibe I get is more and more we are moving to a visual cue web and away from a language driven web, a natural language driven web. And natural language is really important. It describes, you need to use, you know, spoken language to describe stuff. But the cues that users are responding to tend to be more visual, video, large images. And large images are like so 3 years ago, but they're still predominant. Images in search results that attract the eye. Google's new favicon improvements, etc. The web is such a visual medium, so yeah, you can't absolutely can't ignore that.
No,
the
and
way the new layouts are coming.
And speaking of visual, Google has changed its "you visit this often" label to an accordion. It has a little drop down. I don't know why, but
well,
I think
you fit more stuff in a small
I think
space.
it's
That's
creepy.
why.
I think it's creepy. You go to the search results, like, you visit here often. You're like,
Google. I mean,
I know you track
Google's
me,
got an AI going through
it.
Your search history, looking at your midget porn references.
I know,
like,
but when it's in your face, people, I think, get more freaked out about it. So I have a feeling that's why it's now hidden under an accordion. Who's ever going to hit that? I don't know.
Yeah, but wait till your mom's looking over your shoulder and you visit here often comes up and it's a
maybe that's why it's hidden under accordion. It's just a piece of information I don't need. And then on top of it, it's adding like a layer that I have to click to look at. Why? I don't know why I'd even do that. So anyway, I don't know, but they made that change. Google image search on this image. Now, if you do an image search, Google will give you other image searches off the image that you searched.
They've been kind of doing this for a while.
Yeah.
You know, where you could search for products by uploading an image, where you could like search for the origin of an image by uploading the image. So yeah, again, Google is investing a lot of energy in the visual Q web. Something I think that search and digital marketers need to think about a lot is what are users responding to. Google's investing in it because it's what users are responding to.
Maybe. Oh, I don't know if that's always true. but Google has to find a way to stuff as much as it can in their interface. I think that's part of it. But you're right. I don't know. Image search from images. It could be helpful. Google is adding finally support for AVIF images. Google says it's the most popular form of images online. I have to disagree with that. I don't think I've ever seen anyone use an AVIF. And I audit a lot of sites and see a lot of URLs. But apparently now they do have AVIF, though there are some limitations to it. So you want to make sure that it is appropriate for you to be using it. But AVIF is just a faster image file that has, like we went to WebP because it was faster, but retained more of the image itself. So it was better quality and lower compression. And it's offered on WordPress, Joomla, and Cloudflare at the moment.
Okay.
And then
this one I alluded to earlier, if a form discussion comes up in search results, or a results from a form discussion come up, Google's now going to have top comments on that discussion. So, for instance, say using glue to hold cheese on pizza comes up, there may be a comment underneath that says, "Don't do this."
The ones they have now where they have like the little text links and that's how they show the results. Now they're actually going to have boxes.
I think this is a really good thing. If the result's going to come up from a forum, forums are all about conversation. The first result might not have the right information.
You know, that's true. I've gotten that result and it just takes up a lot of real estate for something I'm not interested in. So it's like pull Reddit up, now give it five links and a set of boxes underneath. And so I'm just like, oh, just go away. I don't need you. I don't need all this information. So you're taking up way too much space. I'm not looking for Reddit results.
Careful when you say just go away in relation to Google stuff.
This is true. Google does like to kill things.
You know how I use Google search notifications all the time for when something happens in search from one of my clients. I want to know before they do. Similarly, if you're using Google Trends a lot and you want to have Google Trends inform you how ideas, concept, words are being treated against other ideas, concept, and words, you can set up a subscription service and just have it feed you stats all week long. Well, you could. Because you can't anymore because it's going away next month.
Yep. Bye-bye. you can still use the RSS feed or the subscribe to the newsletter, but they are getting rid of the email alerts, which will make it less, easy if you're using it for things. And I could see people who do like new sites or sites that are in the moment using this quite a bit, but they're taking it away and they don't explain why. So there's no reason to ask.
Google Trends is such a gem. I really like Google Trends a lot. It's integral to the work I do, like choosing words, choosing what to put in a sentence, why to put it there, choosing anchor text. Google Trends is so important.
And also, just to add to that, Google auto-suggests on the dropdown. That comes from actual user data and user engagement. So if you're like, I can't afford an expensive keyword tool, your best keyword tool is just to go to Google search, drop it down, check out Google Trends with whatever you find there.
Bloody hell, absolutely.
All for free. Yeah, all for free. So you can take the root keywords, see what Google suggests, take those words into trends and compare them and see if something is currently popular or more popular than something else.
Okay. This one is really important. YouTube SEO questions answered.
Yes, this is huge.
Greg Jarboe made his bones on being the YouTube guy at search at one time. Now Google's doing it for him. But this is just huge. You want to know how YouTube works? There is now a YouTube liaison.
There is. He looks like he's
watched a bunch
things.
Of YouTube videos.
Like he builds things. Okay. Yeah, so Barry Schwartz has a page, YouTube SEO Questions Answered. He's going to use it as a living page, meaning he's going to continue to add to it when he sees a good question come up. Now, of course, it may branch off later. But right now, if you go to that page, again, YouTube SEO Questions Answered on Search Engine Roundtable by Barry Schwartz, you will actually see where he's pulled in some really big questions that had a lot of engagement that this person answered. His name is Todd. I didn't see his last name though. And he's not familiar to me, but so this is great because I mean, how many times have people asked you how to rank on YouTube? You're like, click on stuff, like stuff, get your stuff liked. Like, so this is great. This will really be helpful because YouTube is a much bigger black box than organic search. So, and they've kept it that way a long time, probably on purpose. I would gather.
YouTube is a traffic machine if you use it properly. It is. I have one client that invested heavily in video creation, and a well-established YouTube channel goes a very long way.
Yeah, you could take the new best practices Google has around video on your site.
Pages, yep.
Create a video section. Make sure you have watch pages. You can Google watch pages to find the specifications on that. Use a YouTube video, and so now you have the capacity not just to get the YouTube video into the rankings, but to get a spot from your website with that YouTube video also into the rankings and in the video spots. But you have to use the watch pages, and you have to. We went into depth in this a week or two ago, so you just need to look up Google video watch pages to know how to create them. But you could definitely you could get some significant traffic. I've seen sites where one video brings like 30,000-50,000 visits a month from YouTube.
My problem with how Google's doing this is an example of Google creating a paradigm that is 100% Google friendly and very less so web merchant friendly. I want my videos to be part of the page that's actually selling the product. I don't want a standalone page or a standalone video, but Google needs that for sorting purposes.
Yeah, exactly.
It's maddening. Because it absolutely breaks the flow of a really, really well-created marketing page. And you can still use the video on your marketing page, absolutely embedded from your YouTube channel, all that sort of stuff. But it's more effort for the same return we were getting a year and a half ago. But we will be getting more traffic in the long run because we're making it easier for Google to sort stuff.
Exactly.
That's the thinking. I don't know if it's actually going to work that way, but that's the thinking.
The number one thing you can say to anybody in SEO is make it easy for Google.
Well, indeed, but Google at the same time, this doesn't seem like a big deal when you think of it as one video and one page, but now think of it as 20 videos and 20 pages, or 200 videos and 200 pages, or 2,000 videos and 2,000 pages, and now we're talking money.
Well, like we talked about before, right? The reason people hate recipe sites now. And so they have to read that thing about when my grandmother came over from the mountains and she brought the spice with her and blah, blah, blah. That's Google. We get blamed for it all the time. I see people don't understand SEO, like slamming SEO. And they're like, that's all because of SEO. It's like, no, Google made us do it. So I can see the same thing happening a couple years down the road when every site has a watch section with a separate page because Google couldn't interpret the video from the page or something. I don't know why, but... obviously, this is a technical issue Google's trying to fix.
Sometime in a not so distant future, where Google does allow us to use hashtags as canonicals.
Exactly. It's like obviously this is like Google couldn't fix it, so Google said, "Okay, we'll make a new specification, and you'll create a watch page." And like, okay, Google, we'll create a watch page because we need the visits. So now we have the watch pages. But now we have also the YouTube SEO question section on Roundtable, which will be super helpful. And a liaison, a YouTube liaison. That's awesome.
Which again, many YouTube advertisers and YouTube creators will wish that this person existed like a decade ago. It's wonderful that they exist now.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, one last story. We're gonna have to do this like super super fast. Google's automatically linking ads and merchant sender accounts. It's an advertising world out there. It's all about pushing the product and not necessarily yours. Ads and merchant center accounts now linked together.
On October 3rd.
Oh, sorry, as of October 3rd.
As of October 3rd. So it'll be automatic. You should have a message in your account. And if that is a bad thing for you, I don't think Google's going to care. So you'll have to get used to it. Kind of like we did with G4.
Kind of like we did with G4. And you know what? I just found great utility in G4 again. Another new utility. I'm now able to spot when bots show up in the traffic stream. I mean, what they're doing exactly yet, but they can show up. They can tell you when they showed up, which is our AI crawler bots show up, which is a kind of cool thing. GA4, GA4 allows you to do very simply. So
awesome!
Yay, done. Okay, we've gone full clock. It's few minutes after the hour we started the show on. So on behalf of Christine Schackinger from Sites Without Walls, this is Jim Hedge from Digital Always Media. You've been listening to Webcology, recorded live to podcast on the 5th of September, 2024. Summer is really, honest to goodness, almost over. It really ends for in you. 2 weeks. No, for everybody. You. Everybody. No. It's the 21st, no matter where you are.
Today. It's 103 today.
Well,
our summer starts when everyone else's ends.
Unless you're going to melt, get outside and enjoy it. If you are going to melt, be very careful going outside. And take care for people who do have to be there. Enjoy summer while you have it. It's serious season now. September has begun. The conference season's begun again. We're moving towards Christmas holiday season. Thanksgiving and Black Friday and Cyber Monday are coming way sooner than you think. Rank well, take care of your websites, be kind to each other, and we'll talk to you next week.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.